Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives. And this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's Crime Beat broadcast presents Karen Gravano, the daughter of Sammy the Bull Gravano. Sammy Gravano was responsible for putting the notorious John Gotti behind bars. Karen Gravano will discuss her intriguing and fascinating book titled Mob Daughter, The Mafia, Sammy the Bull Gravano and Me. Karen Gravano is also one of the stars of Mob Wives, the popular hit American reality TV series airing on VH1 TV. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director, publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ronnie Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from Thunder Bay area, with Volume 2 coming out next year. And this summer, he'll publish another book about the famous Canola shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. You're getting at that promo. You're getting better at that promo all the time. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is almost sold out. So thank you very much for that. Well, Ronnie, it's going to be a great show, so we invite our listeners to stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some of the mail we received, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. We've got about 135,000 listeners around the globe. That's around the globe. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony for making this show possible. Also, a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their music for our theme song. Well, Roddy, now here is this week's mailbag. This one is from Lou Diaz, author of Dancing with the Devil, Confessions of an Undercover Agent. Lou writes, "Hi, Ron and Willie. Got to listen to your show with Joe Pistone. It was like listening to the many things I had to say about working undercover, minus my flamboyance. I share and agree with many of the things he had to say. Keep up the great work, and congrats, Ronnie, and on your recent laudits and accomplishments." Now, this one is from Max of British Columbia, Canada. He writes, "Loved your show with Joe Pistone a couple of weeks ago. Donnie Brasco, the book, was a fascinating read, and the movie with Al Pacino and Johnny Depp was even better. How Joe Pistone sacrificed 6 years of his life by going undercover, infiltrating the mob, is simply beyond me." Hey, great letters, Ronnie. Any comments?
Really, it was great to hear from Louis Diaz, and one of the things that Joe said, Louis also said, he could have gone either way. He could have gone the mob way, or he could have gone, you know, the straight way, and, you know, growing up in New York City. And we had Lou Ferrante on, who went the wrong way. So yeah. It was a very interesting discussion. I learned a lot about undercover work from Joe Pistone, and it was a real honor to have him on the show. And he deserves everything he got in life for the 6 years he sacrificed as an undercover agent.
Absolutely a sacrifice, but, kudos go out for him. He put down a lot of bad people. Well, Ronnie boy, You want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, please.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners thought that O.J. did it, right? He was responsible for the death of Nicole and Ron Goldman. But we have an author on next week, William Deere, an investigator who claims that O.J. is innocent. He actually wrote a book called O.J. is Innocent, and I can prove it. It's over 400 pages long, and I read it. And I tell you, it's a fascinating read. And you'd be surprised who he says was the killer of Nicole and Ron. So we're looking forward to that show, and I'm sure it'll stir up a lot of interest.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's going to be a great, that's a great read, and we urge all our listeners to get out that, get and buy that book. Okay, Ronnie, thanks for that. Tell our listeners what you've been up to and your upcoming projects, please.
Right. I was up in Miami Tuesday for a shoot with A&E. They're doing a gangster series coming up, and they wanted me on the show because of my book, Queenpins, and I profiled three Queenpins. Prominent Queenpins for that show. It looks like an interesting show. It's supposed to be coming out in August, and we'll keep our listeners tuned, and hopefully we'll get maybe the producers on that show to time it to the upcoming release of that series. And this Thursday I'll be in Philadelphia for the release of our documentary, Frank Matthews Story. We're having a screening, and so it's a pretty exciting time. Willie?
Well, that's great, Ronnie. I'll tell you something. You're going places, buddy. Way to go. Congrats, and keep up the great work. Now, I'll tell you something. The beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present a rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. And crime news you missed. Well, we're gonna do one. We started off a bit late this show. We had a bit of a technical difficulty. But anyway, Dateline, California. June 12th, Goodfellas mobster Henry Hill, dead at age 69. Henry Hill, the notorious mobster whose life was basis for the film Goodfellas, has died. Hey, Ronnie, we just had him on our show. What a great guest. Any comments?
Right. He was on about 4 months ago, and the death was really sudden. Lisa Casero, who I talked with his girlfriend to line up him for the show, Henry for the show, said his heart just stopped. And he went out peacefully, not exactly like a good fella. So he's 69 years old. We had him on the show. We were hoping to get him back on. He was doing a book on the Lufthansa heist. Remember that famous heist in the movie? And unfortunately, we're not going to have him on. But it was really amazing, the reaction. I mean, he was all over the place. MSNBC.
He was all over the map, yeah. All the networks,
right.
CNN, everywhere.
The headlines on Yahoo. I watched NBC last night, political show. And, they went from pontificating about the election to Henry Hill. So it was really amazing, the reaction.
Amazing, amazing
guy.
You
could have more than your 15 minutes of fame, right?
That's right. Well, he turned his life around later on. May he rest in peace, Ronnie. Now, just before we get on to our special guest, we'll take a station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening. So if you've missed one, you can check it out anytime. If you have any questions for our guests, you can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll also be glad to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Karen Gravano. In her fascinating book, which made the New York Times bestseller list, titled Mob Daughter, The Mafia, Sammy the Bull Gravano and Me, comes a revealing memoir of a mafia childhood. Her story is about a daughter's struggle to reconcile the image of her loving father with that of a mafioso, and how, in healing the rift between the two, she was able to forge a new life. It's going to be a great show. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Karen Gravano.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your book. I thought it was an excellent read. How is it doing?
It's doing phenomenal. Actually, I talked to the publisher, and it's in its fourth reprint. It just sold the life rights in the UK, so I'm really excited. It's just I couldn't ask for a better reaction. I really feel blessed.
Well, that's great. And we had your co-author Lisa Pulitzer on. She's to talk about her book about Joan Vandersloot. How is it working with Lisa? She's a good writer, isn't she?
She's an amazing writer, and she's just an amazing personality. She really captured my voice. And when I was doing this book, it was kind of complicated because I wanted to be able to tell the truth, and I love my father, but I didn't want to try to come out like I was portraying him to be something he's not, because I didn't see Sammy the Bull. I seen Sammy the father. So, but I wanted to be able to express to her everything that I was feeling and still maintain that certain respect and admiration and love that I have for him. And she just really was able to get it across in my voice. We sat down for hours. I told her things, and she would type it word for word what I was saying, and then she'd go home and fix it up and send it to me and say, do you want to fix it, change it? So she's not only an amazing writer, she was able to put the story together the way I want and, you know, get it out there, but she's also an amazing friend and personality, and she listened to me and really did exactly what I wanted. So I have much respect for Lisa.
You were a great team, and the cover's great, too. You look great in red.
You know, the cover was actually...
That's definitely your color. That's definitely a color. Do you have anything to do with the cover?
Yes. Well, the cover was actually a promo shoot for Mob Wives for the show for season one. And it's kind of funny how it came about, because when I was taking the picture there, it said, give me your biggest gangster look. So I kind of, like, put my head up and gave the look. And the publishing house, St. Martin, they loved the picture. They were like, we love this picture. We want to be able to use it. So I wanted to do a retake and do like a nice picture, like sitting down on a couch, looking a little bit more professional. But I guess we kind of went with the whole, the red cover and the dress and the coloring and everything. It stands out. I will say that.
Right. Well, I'll tell
it fits
you,
like a glove, Karen. It fits like a glove.
I can see people walking down the aisle in the bookstore and just stopping because of the cover. So I think it does the job. What kind of reaction are you getting from people? You know, your father was a very controversial character, and you know he's one of the most famous, or I guess you could say infamous characters in mob history. And what have the reactions been from the public?
You know, at first when I was writing the book, I took a lot of criticism, and people tried to stop it. There's a lot of people that claim to be victims of my father or of that. Well, they're not claiming to be victims of the lifestyle. They're only claiming to be victims of my father, which I find to be a little hypocritical. So at first they were trying to stop it, and they couldn't. And, you know, I was there saying it's blood money. I'm trying to make money off my father's life and the crime, but it's my life, and it's what I went through. And honestly, I feel like there's so many misconceptions about mafia families and what the family goes through, and I really wanted to shed light because I do believe there's a dark side. I was never glorifying it. Like, I'm not a gangster, so I wasn't writing a mob book. This is a family story and struggle. You know, it's a relationship that I had with my father and how the decisions and choices he made in life affected mine because I allowed them to. And when I learned that, you know, I had to be accountable for who I am, and I can't let what people say or how they judge him affect me, and I just, you know, and which I did for a long time and made mistakes because of it. I felt like my life just came full circle. I had a full understanding of who I am, who my father is, the choices and decisions he made, and the choices and decisions I made, and I was just ready to put it out there.
Right. What you just said comes through in the book, you know, that conflict, you know, between telling the way it is and dealing with your father, who you obviously loved, right?
Oh, I love him to death. I mean, he's more than a father to me. He's a friend. He was a provider, a protector back then. But especially now in my older years, like I'm 40, so I could say my older years, my later years, he's really a friend. So that's what's important. And, yeah, I do love him.
Did you tell him that you were writing a book before you started it?
Yes, I told him I was going to write a book, and at first he was like, what kind of story do you have? And I was like, you know, even though you were the gangster and you think that the only story lies within you, it's what we had to go through. And I had to go through a lot of stuff. I had to get up every day while you were in jail and face the people that were once my family and friends and not know who to trust, not fully understand. Like, when we grew up in that lifestyle, he kept us secluded, even though he thought he didn't keep us in it at all. We were still around, you know, every family event, like my uncles were there and their wives, and they were gangsters, so we were still attached to that lifestyle, although we didn't know what was going on. So I don't think he really seen how much it affected us, because when he went to prison, I think he just thought like we were going to go away, go live somewhere, we were going to be fine. But it didn't happen that way, and everybody turned on us. And you know, there was a lot of things that I went through. He didn't know what it felt like to come home and not know if somebody's going to do something to you because of, you know, what your father is. And somebody that you have once trusted and loved. So it was kind of, I went through a lot of stuff, and I think that for a long time I put blame on my father because I didn't understand. I was rebellious. I wanted to act out and be bad because I wanted to gain acceptance in my community. Mm-hmm. And I didn't only feel like it was my community. I also felt like society judged him. You know, here's John Gotti, and he's on the cover of the Daily News and the New York Times, and he's the Dapper Don, the King of New York. And here's Sammy the Bull. He's a rat. He's a stool pigeon. So this wasn't the men that I grew up with saying this. This was the newspaper. So I just felt like at that point, you have to be bad to gain respect. And I made my mistakes off of, you know, the lifestyle he chose.
Right. Has he read the book?
Have I read it?
No, Sammy, has his father read the book?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I read it 100 times, and then I had to say it and read it out loud and read it and film it.
What did he think of it?
You know, at first, he was like, when I started telling him I was doing it and I started writing it, I was like, oh, I don't want to send him this. It would be like a chapter, and I wanted to get his opinion, but then I'm thinking he might not understand. So me and him made an agreement. He said, it's your book. It's your thing. I want you to tell your story. You know, I know he's like a little bit of a control freak a little bit, so I know it probably killed him, but he didn't see anything, and I sent it out to him on February 14th, the day it became public, and I didn't hear from him for a week, and I was like freaking out. I'm telling my mother, you think he's mad? And he called, and he said, I read your book 3 times, and I want to apologize to you. He's like, no matter how hard I always thought that I was protecting you guys, I never realized how involved you were in my life and how it affected you. And if I would have known half the things that I've known now, you know, maybe if I would have known that you were that little kid eavesdropping behind the wall while I was talking and you were uncertain or scared or confused about the things that you heard, maybe I would have made a different choice in life. But sometimes when you think you're doing the best thing for your family, it turns out to be the worst. But at the end of the day, I love you. And, you know, I was like, I love you. I think that, you know, who you are as a person and the relationship that we have made me who I am today. And I guess, you know, the message in this book is no matter what you go through, you can't choose the hand you're dealt. You can only play the game. And if you get knocked down or you lose a hand, you got to pick yourself back up and keep going forward.
Right. Well, obviously, you had a lot of downs in your life. You know, it's really amazing, especially in business and everything. We'll talk about that. Well, how is your father doing in prison? You say he read your book 3 times. Well, how's he doing? How's he hanging up? I know he's got a condition, right? That sounds pretty serious.
And for
Graves' disease?
Yes, it was Graves' disease. He actually has it in remission. He is completely healthy. Like, I mean, he still always is going to have it. He has to take medication, but he works out. He did 7 years in solitary confinement. And to be honest, when he first came out, he wasn't on as sharp as he used to be. You know, you can tell when you're talking to him, it kind of took an effect. But I don't know if it's me being on Mob Wives and him watching me, but now he's as sharp as a tack, and he is on it. He hates the show. He calls me every Monday and, like, yells at me, I can't believe you said this. I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, don't ever say that, bro. It's just, I think that he's good. He's doing well.
Well, you said he was 7 years in solitary confinement. Was that for his own protection, or is it because he was doing...
You know, no, he wasn't doing anything in prison. I mean, I believe that they said it was for his own protection, but I also feel like, you know, the government might have been a little bit embarrassed about what happened. You know, he went to jail. He cooperated on the Gotti trial. He came out after 6 years and came to Arizona where my whole entire family got arrested. So to me, I almost felt like it was a way of just kind of like getting rid of him. He spent 5 years in the ADX, in the Supermax.
Wow. Wow. And, how did he come out of that? Did it affect his health? And
you know, in the beginning, like I said, anytime you're someplace and you don't get out of your cell but 1 hour a day and you have no human contact and, you know, you only get one 15-minute call a month, you're definitely going to come out a little beat up. But like I said, now it's just, you know, he's been out of that for a while. He's kind of, you know, he's in constant contact with us. So he's doing real well. He works out again. I mean, I keep having to tell him that he's getting up there. He's acting like he's in his 40s all over again.
Right. He gets out in 2019, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes.
You're right on that then. And so I guess you have to settle with visits. Do you visit him much?
You know, when he was in the ADX Supermax, he didn't want any visits because it was just really poor conditions. He was under, you know, he had to be shackled the whole time. It was just a poor environment to visit him in. So we didn't know where he is. I at least try to visit him 2 to 3 times a year. My mother goes and my brother goes. So he gets visits, but not all the time. I think for him, it's easier for him not to get visits. And now, like I said, after the show airs, I think he feels like he sees me every Sunday. So after some shows, he don't ever want to speak to me or see me again. But, yeah. The show's the book. He loves the book. He stands behind it. He understands it. It made him look at things in a whole different light. Again, it was through a child's eyes. And you never really, I mean, I guess he never looked at it through my eyes. Mobwise is a whole different beast, you know, for him. I think he gets it, but he realizes at first he felt that it wasn't a woman's position to get up on television and talk about the mob, and then when he realized it was about women and all the craziness and bickering and drama that we go through, now he's just a little like, you're a mother, and I feel like your story is so much more, like you've been through so much to come back and be fist fighting and throwing plates over ex-boyfriends. So now he has an issue with the language and the fighting. But like I said, it's, you know, we act normal and we don't have viewers. We beat each other up and we have 2.5 million people cheering us on. So.
Yeah, Ronnie, I got a quick one for Karen, if you don't mind.
Excuse me, Willie, let me just finish one thing. You're talking about the fighting. A lot of people have issue with the fighting. Is that real? Is that what you see on Mobwise, or is that
you know, it is so real with us, and that's the thing that I think people don't get, is because we have so much history. And like I said, it's a lifestyle that there was so much hurt and so much pain. And like for me, I feel like I've been through so much in my life, and I stood up to everything. I never ran. I never hid. So now I get on TV and I have a girl trying to bully me. Like, that's not my personality. Like, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm sorry. So I'm going to stand up and fight for what I believe in. And I think our personalities are all so strong, but there is such deep history there that you're seeing it. And, yes, it gets crazy, and sometimes it gets out of hand. And they probably focus in on the wildest parts of it. You know, it's not like we're always just screaming, flinging plates, but they probably focus in when they're editing the show just on the major craziness. So it looks like we're crazy all the time. But, for us, it's definitely not scripted. Sometimes I wish it was, or I can be like, oh, no, they made me say that.
I got a quick one for Karen. You know, Mobwise, it must be cathartic for you, I suppose. What's it like on the set? Describe a typical shoot with the other girls.
I mean, it's definitely stressful. It's like, you could sit there and also, like, sometimes you'll see us and we'll be there for 2 hours having a dinner, and then we can be talking about just shooting the breeze about the weather, our kids. And then all of a sudden they'll say, bring up something that Drita said about Karen. And then they do. And then it goes left. You know what I mean? And it's like, I had so much drama in my life. I feel like for the last couple of years, I lived so drama free, and now I'm here and it looks like that's all we do, but it is what it is. You know, I think for all the girls, it's like 1 minute we love each other, the next minute we don't. I said we love hard, we fight hard, but we're all in this. And one thing I did say on the show is, no matter what it is, I'm always going to be connected to these women one way or another, because I feel like I was a single mom raising my daughter because her father made poor choices and went to jail. So are all these other women. And hopefully at this point we can use this as a turning point and start teaching people that drama isn't the way. Because I'll be honest, there were times where I would watch the show and think I want to shut it off. And I watched Mobwise Chicago not too long ago and was like, I quit. Because I feel like everything now, like even the other shows like Basketball Wives, and just like all these wives are seeming to come out and start fighting, that I think to me it's a little bit too much now. So for me, my character, I'm definitely, when I go into my negotiations in season 3, I'm going to be a whole different Karen. I might be boring because I'm just going to be who I really am, and that's a mother, a businesswoman. I mean, I say crazy things. But that fighting stuff to me is not, I hope that I never have to get into that again. But again, I will say if someone tries to hit me, I'm going to defend myself. And that's what I think in Mobwise, you know, Drita kept trying to hit me, and I just went nuts.
All right. Willie, let's take a station break and continue this fascinating discussion with Karen Carvano. Author of Mob Daughter. Go ahead, Willie.
Absolutely. What a great guest. Great show. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Our special guest this evening is Karen Carvano, author of Mob Daughter, The Mafia, Sammy the Bull, Carvano and Me. Now back to Ron and Karen Carvano.
Thank you, Willie. And Karen has a website, www. KarenGravano.com, which has a lot of interesting things on it, including things for sale. Right, Karen?
Yes. It's KarenGravano.com, and it has there's a whole bunch of stuff on there. It has updated like tours or book signings, and you know, my brother also has one, which is the Gravanos.com, and that has family recipes because my brother's a chef, so we've been working on a lot of family recipes and stuff, and maybe my next book might be a cookbook.
That would be a switch. You're also on Facebook and Twitter, right?
Yes, I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and Twitter is Karen Gravano VH1.
Right, and as Willie pointed out, it's a bestseller, so you can get this book anywhere, Amazon.com. You can go to your bookstore. If it's not there, you can order it. So it's widely available, and I recommend it. I think it's a great read. Interesting part of your book, important part, interesting scene is you know, your attitude to your father's cooperation with the police. Right? Are you over that now? Where you were really angry with your father as became a government informant?
I completely now 100% understand why he did what he did. Back then I didn't understand it, you know, and I think that now through the years and through there are certain things that happen in history with other people's cases, and you know, it's just I believe my father felt that John Gotti betrayed him, and in that lifestyle he betrayed him back. But I couldn't understand it then, you know, when they were playing with Gotti tapes and I was sitting there listening to Gotti bad-mouthing my father. I still couldn't understand why he would cooperate. You know, it took me a while, and I felt more abandoned by him. Like, I felt, this is a man who's always taught me, like, if me and my brother were fighting each other for over the air condition, I wanted it cold, he wanted it hot, he would tell us to go upstairs and handle it. Like, we couldn't tell on each other. So to me, it was like everything he taught me never to do that. Now he's doing it. It took me a long time to really understand why he cooperated. And I think that he was just sick and tired of the life. You know, I think that he felt John betray him, and his first initial reaction was he needs to go, he needs to kill him, and that's usually the ultimate thing in that lifestyle when someone betrays you. But I think he started really doing a lot of soul searching and realizing that he was just done, he wanted a different way, and I mean, I guess that was his way to just get out of it.
Right. So how does it feel about being a government informant today? Does he still feel the same way as he did when he made his decision?
He still 100% backs who he is in his decision. I don't think he ever liked being a government informant. I don't think that that was something that he got up and said, I turned my life and I turned it around. I like what I did. I think he was just disgusted with a lot of the choices that he made, and ultimately he has to live with them every day. You know, he's not like, I regret cooperating. I regret a lot of things that I did, but you can't live with regret. So it's how I push forward and move forward. Now the thing I hope to do is be there for you as a father, help advise you, help, you know, you go in a positive direction. Hopefully everything that I've done wrong in my life and everything that you've done wrong and everything, you know, that made us get to that point, we can use to help my daughter, my nephew, have a better life. And maybe people outside of that. Like, for me, my book has a message, and I think a lot of people become products of their environment. See, me growing up, I felt like these men around me, they were all good men. I seen so much respect from people would give them, and, you know, the way they'd walk into a restaurant, they'd have the best service. You get a car, your car, and they would tip people, and people love them. So I never seen them to be bad men. But then when it came out, and everyone's saying they're bad, they're criminals, they're this, they're that, then I was like, okay, well, if they're so bad, why do they get so much respect? So me, and it's unfortunate that I thought this way, but the truth is I felt like that's what you have to be. You have to be bad to get respect. And when my father cooperated, I felt like everybody turned on me, society as a whole, the people in my community. So I wanted to be bad because I wanted people to like me again. And it was unfortunate that I made those choices. Nobody made me make them. I made them myself. I just didn't, for the wrong reasons, because I cared about what people think. And again, I became a product of my environment. I felt like I wanted to still fit in. And I think that in my book, that's the message. And, you know, it's just hard when you're growing up, but people really should focus more on school, education, and just really trying to empower themselves. But, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate that that's always happened. But hopefully after reading this, or if I can, I'm actually working with a foundation, and it's called Books from, it's a book bank foundation, and it works with inner city kids to help them learn the importance of literacy and be able to get off the street corner and go, you know, write or read a book or educate themselves. So
right.
If I can give back, that's what I'd like to give back.
At the next break, we'll get the website address. so people can look up the foundation and maybe make a donation on that or maybe help out on that. But the interesting part of your book and a big part of it is, you know, growing up, you know, as a Toronto daughter, and really life was pretty good. There was a lot of perks being the daughter of a mob boss, right?
Absolutely.
Right. You know, you talk about John Gotti at your Sweet 16 party. Tell us about that.
Hey, I had a Sweet 16 party at Pastel's, you know, and it's kind of funny because I had a whole bunch of uncles there, and a lot of times men come without their wives. There's just certain people, and there was a whole bunch of kids, but all the guys were up in one corner, and the kids and the women were around dancing, and I remember John walked in, and you could have, like, heard a pin drop. All eyes were on him. He's very charismatic. Like, when he walked into a room, he definitely was able to catch people's attention and hold it. He conducted himself. He walked. He was very, you know, you wanted to know about him, and then you'd see him on the news. He was like a movie star, and all my friends were, like, whispering, there's John Gotti, there's John Gotti. I remember walking over, like, being annoyed because I felt like he was taking the attention off of me. So my father was like, come here, say hello to Uncle John. And I said hello to Uncle John. He handed me an envelope, and, you know, I opened up the envelope, not in front of him, but I went in the bathroom and opened it up because it felt thick, and I had $1,000 in there, you know, 10 $100 bills. So that's just, you know, and that's, you know, have enjoy a kiddo, do good, save up for a car. Like, that's the type of thing I've seen these men. I've never seen a vicious, violent side of them.
Yeah, hey, Karen, but, when you were growing up, you know, you're a very attractive young lady. You must have had a lot of guys calling you for dates. How did your father deal with that? What kind of advice did you or your parents give you, especially your dad?
My father was always respect yourself, and it's kind of funny that you bring that up because I had my daughter in the car who's 12 and Ramona who's on the show, her two daughters, and I was just giving them the same advice. And it's anything my father would always tell me, you always have to respect yourself and then people will respect you. So if you're the girl that's going to be out there, then, you know, everybody's going to have a piece of you. No one's ever going to really want you. And he always told me, even when I'm dealing with anyone, you know, always treat people as your equal. But no, pay attention to the angle if somebody wants something, and just always respect yourself. And, you know, you can't always put your guard up to where you might not get hurt, but if you get hurt, you have to dust yourself off and keep on moving. So, I mean, he never threatened me, like, I'll kill your boyfriend or anything like that. No, I get that question all the time. I'm sure if my boyfriend broke up with me, it wouldn't have been a problem. He probably would have been happy if he broke up with me. If he didn't want to be with me, then he would be happy that we weren't together. He definitely wanted me to be with someone that wanted to be with me. But, you know, it's just, if I had the type of boyfriend that would have beat me up or put his hands on me, I think like any other father, he would have protected me the same way. And listen, I know fathers, and I've read stories in the newspaper where men weren't gangsters and someone did something to their daughter and they killed them or beat them up or put them in a hospital, you know? I have a daughter, and if God forbid someone really hurt my daughter, and this is not because I'm Sam of the Bull's daughter, not because my last name is Gravano, if someone hurt my daughter, I would do everything in my power to protect her. So I think, you know, he was a father when it came to that. He set his gangster ways aside, but yet, I mean, he can always be that gangster, I guess, if he needed to be.
Well, you were quite young when you began to suspect that your father was a gangster. I think you were about nine years old, right? And can you recall the circumstances? How over the years you began to say, hey, you know, to yourself, my dad is not exactly who I think he is, and he's much more, you know, complex than I thought.
Well, there's a couple of incidents that stood out in my life. I always knew that he was a little different, but then he had these people around him that were the same, and some of them were my friend's fathers, so I would think that they were different than the kids at school's dads. And they had, you know, 9 to 5, like their father would pick them up after work. And when I was younger, my father didn't. He had after hours and, you know, but as I started to get older and as he started to grow in the mob, he started to become very militant with the way he conducted himself. And he put himself on a regiment. Like, he wasn't in nightclubs all the time out or doing, you know, whatever. He'd come home, he'd, you know, wake up in the morning, go to the gym, go to his construction office, come home, have dinner with the family, and then go, you know, to Mulberry Street and meet with John and then come home. So to me, I've seen that side of him. But when he was younger, it was different. When I was younger, it was different because he had nightclubs. So I always felt like he was just cooler than the other dads. And but when I was when I was 9 years old, I was 10 years old, I'm sorry, I wanted to have a sleepover, and I was waiting for him to come home, and like I said, he was cool. I figured it's going to not be a problem. He's going to say yes, because he almost always did, and I could tell that my mother was, like, nervous about something, but she didn't know what was going on. My father probably just called her. Maybe she sensed in his voice or something that something was wrong. So she just told me I couldn't have a sleepover that night, and I kept persisting, and she's like, you know, you're going to have to ask your father when he comes home, and I don't think tonight's going to be a good night. We can definitely have it tomorrow. So sure enough, I was outside playing, and my father comes home, and he jumps out the car, and he waves to me and just runs up in the house. So I follow after him, and the bedroom door was closed, and I pushed it open, and I seen him tuck a gun into the back of his pants. And, you know, for a minute you kind of pause, but he didn't act nervous. He didn't act anything. He just acted very regular. So he's like, don't you knock? And I said, no, I was going to ask you if I can have a sleepover. And he said, no, tonight's not a good night. And he walked by me, walked down the stairs, and I could tell, like, his body language. And normally he always would sit down, talk to me. Like, he just wasn't paying me much attention. Like, he was preoccupied. So I think that he realized that I might have sensed something, and then he came back up and he goes, I promise you can have a sleepover this weekend, kiddo. Kissed me on the head, said a couple of jokes, and left. So I didn't think, like, oh, my God, he's leaving the house. He's acting crazy, something weird, something bad's about to happen. He acted very calm, so that's what I see. I forgot about the gun. The next morning, I woke up and read that the man that was buying his nightclub was murdered outside. And I think you think about it for a minute. And, like, same thing, the next morning I came in, I think he seen me reading the paper, and he walked in and I stopped, and he's just acting normal, he's joking. So, you know, here I am, 10 years old, thinking, could he have done it? But no, look how he's acting, he's so normal, he's not upset, he's not nervous, you know, and I just didn't think about it anymore. I don't think as a kid you really think what your parents do when they leave the house. And I know that sounds, you know, maybe I put it somewhere in my brain where I blocked it out, and that's probably what I did do. But it didn't seem like it was just he was leaving town. Like, you know, you'd think if someone murdered someone, they'd be nervous, they'd be leaving town. It was just, you know, you can't see it because it's such it's controlled. And the people around him, my uncles came over, everybody's joking, nobody's acting suspicious. So why should I be suspicious?
Right. Willie, let's take a break and we'll go into the final part of our program.
You bet. What a great interview. At this time, we will take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. Now back to Ron Chepsik and Karen Gravano for the remainder of our program.
Yes, we're back with Karen Gravano, author of Mob Daughter, The Mafia, Sammy the Bull, and Me. And you can go to her website, www.karengravano.com. It's a real interesting website with a store. Your book is a bestseller, so you can get it anywhere. And Karen, the web address of the foundation that you're involved with.
It's just the bookbankfoundation.org.
Bookbankfoundation.org. Okay, that sounds great. And getting back to our interview, but eventually, you know, you did learn that your father was responsible for several murders. What went through your mind when you finally knew, you know, the truth about your father?
Well, I mean, I think when the Castellano hit happened, he was still on the streets. I knew at that point that he was involved in that. But it's almost like it was hard. It was surreal. Like, everything was happening so fast. I felt like I was watching from the outside, even though it was my life. And I almost felt bigger. Like, I'm part of something that's big, but I didn't really know how to take it. And then, like, again, like I said, you're still not looking at it, or I wasn't at the point, like, these men are bad, because it's like, okay, here they are in the newspaper. People are saying, you know, they killed Paul Castellano, or they did this, they did that, but yet I'd walk down the street, and there'd be, like, this little old lady, like, oh, Sammy's here, I gave this, bring this to your wife, I made you this. So I'm like, why do these people want to be so close to him or respect him? And, you know, when people say because they feared him, that it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure that out, Karen. It was a different kind. It was a respect. And I know the difference between fear and respect because I was around people that people feared. But, you know, I just really didn't look at it. And then when he cooperated, it's like I really sat back and took everything in. And I was devastated, you know, when I woke up and seen that newspaper there with the 19 tombstones. But, and this is completely honest, I felt so confused, so scared that he cooperated. I didn't know what's going to happen. I was 19 years old, I'm looking at it like, okay, well, maybe people will look at it and think that he's dangerous, and they will fear him and not want to hurt us. So I really, when he cooperated, I felt betrayed, I felt confused, I felt scared. I didn't know who to trust. I wasn't thinking about the murders until, you know, much later where we actually sat down. And listen, I believe, and I say this, and this is why I did write the book, I feel like families are victims because we don't make those choices, although we do live the life. So it's hard for me to sit here and say, oh my God, when I realized everything, I'm such a victim, and, you know, I hate my father. I live that life. I understand it. I do not condone it. But I know who he is as a father, and I choose not to be a victim. I choose to be a survivor and be able to learn from all his mistakes, put it behind me, and move forward. And it's unfortunate that there are so many people that lost their lives, but all of these men have made conscious decisions to be part of that life. And like I said, my father had a hit out on him. I'm sure if he came home tomorrow and came back to New York, there may be some issues or whatever it is, and that's something that I always have to live with. And if, God forbid, that happened, I'm going to be upset. I'm going to be devastated. But I'm also going to understand that that's a life that he chose. So I think as family members and children and everybody, instead of us all pointing the finger, and this is where I get into where I did write the book and everyone saying, sue her for her money. She has no right to speak on it. I have every right to speak on what I went through in my life, the mistakes that I made because of his lifestyle and the choices he made, but how I learned from them. And I stand by that and I will speak on it. But I also feel we should all stand up as families and shed light on it and be able to move past it so there aren't kids that look up to this lifestyle and think it's good or they want to be gangsters. It hurts. It rips families apart. People go to prison. But, you know, it's just, it's the choices that they made. We have to live with them, and we have to be able to understand them to move past them.
Oh, how does your father feel about those murders today? Does he have any regrets, or does he feel this, you know, the same way that was just mafia business?
It was mafia business. Like he said, when I was a soldier and sent to Vietnam, I would have killed for this country. When I decided to give up everything and become a soldier to Cosa Nostra, that's something that was expected of me. Do I feel bad? Absolutely. I feel bad at the choices that I made, but I understand why. You know, if someone sat me down and said, Sammy, here, and I'm a kid again, do you want to be a gangster or do you want to be a legitimate man? And I used to think, this is him speaking, the legitimate people were the nerds. You know, they were taking the easy way out. He was the tough guy. He says, I see it differently now. So I would tell anyone the truth is go to school, educate yourself, work hard for what you want, and you'll respect it more. You can go to bed at night and, you know, close your eyes and rest on your pillow and be happy to wake up in the morning. That's what I would do, but that's not what I did. So I can't get up every day and say, oh, my God, I regret it. This happened. It is what it is, and we have to live with it.
Right. You're a pretty high-profile figure. Have you ever had any threats on your life because of who you are and then your father?
Well, I'm very cautious, and I will be a fool to say that it never crossed my mind. People close to us, my father didn't hurt a lot of people. He didn't cooperate. You know, people close to that world or, you know, just people that cared about me, like they show me a lot of support here in New York. But now it's become a whole different thing where you have to pay attention because when you're in the public eye, you know, it's weird. The other day I had my daughter, we were out to eat and this lady came over and she like grabbed her. And my first thing is like to hug her. And I'm like, whoa, 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 don't touch my daughter. You know, like, who are you? You're a stranger. But it's like you expose yourself and you put yourself out there. So, you know, I definitely travel with, I don't have security with me all the time, but if I go to events and stuff, I think just because we're in the public, that we have security with us, and that's everybody on Mob Wives, you know, sometimes. So I'm very conscious. I do try to keep my daughter very sheltered. That's why you don't see her a lot on the show. And, you know, everyone's, is she here? Is she in Arizona? I try to keep that as private as possible, but we do go back and forth. And I choose to keep her a little bit out of it and kind of more grounded in Arizona for the majority of the time. So,
How old is your daughter, Karen? How old is she?
She's 12.
She's 12, I see, okay.
12 years old on that. But, you know, your father spent 6 years in jail, and you went out to Arizona, and you took about 2 years to get out there, but you finally went. But then, there was an incident, and Sammy was arrested, your mother, Deborah, And
my whole family was arrested. I was arrested. My brother.
Including you. And what happened? You know, what happened out there?
When we got out there, I had so much resentment towards my father, so much animosity. I still wanted to feel like I wanted respect. I started dating bad boys and all this other stuff, so I wasn't listening to what he was telling me. I let all the wrong people in my life. Gerard and I got involved in selling drugs, and when I was feared that Gerard was going to come back to New York and do something, because then, you know, do something, and Gerard already had a hit on his life that the FBI had told my brother, my father about and stuff. I feared that something was going to happen to him, so I told my father. When my father found out, at first he flipped out. I think he thought about it. I think he thought long and hard about the life. He knows what it is. He was a hitman. He understands, you know, the problems that Gerard can bring upon himself. So my father felt at that point, if I lend you money, don't go back to New York. And I know that sounds stupid, and we all live with it. You know, a normal, average, law-abiding citizen would say, you lent your son money to buy drugs. And my father would say, yeah, I did, because I feared he was going to go back to New York and get killed. It was a mistake. We live by it. We understand. We're never saying we didn't do anything wrong. But the whole thing got way blown out of proportion because of who my father was. You know, it became Sammy the Bull. He's selling drugs. And, you know, the whole investigation was a five-year investigation on this kid, Mike Papa. He meets my brother for a year. Gerard gets involved within a couple months, and the whole thing turns to the Gravano organization. And I guess at the end of the day, we just have to chalk it up as because of my father's past life, because of the mistakes he made, because of the things that he did, because of mistakes that I made after that and people that we put ourselves around, we put ourselves in that position. I accept it. It is what it is. It was definitely blown up out of proportion, but, you know, at this point, it's, you can't live with regrets. You have to move forward. And he's in prison. And like he said, I wouldn't be in this position if I wasn't Sammy the Bull. You guys wouldn't have been in this position if, you know, you weren't who you are. And that's just like anything. If, God forbid, I do something wrong today, it's going to be intensified because I'm on Mob Wife, you know. So you have to realize who you are. And when you're in the public eye, when you're infamous, famous, whatever it is, you bear a lot more. It becomes more of an issue to do something wrong. So, again, I don't deny that we did it. I think that there should have been jail time. I take the responsibility for what I did. I think it was definitely, but, you know, blown out of proportion. Everything was put on my father. And at the end of the day, he took pleas to you know, get rid of all our jail time. Well, me and my mother.
At the end of the day, you describe yourself as a survivor, but I think you're a thriver. Yeah, I think you're doing tremendously well, considering the, you know, the life you're leading and given, and we wish you great success in the future. And we thank you for being on the show. We run out of time. We can go on for another hour talking about your fascinating story, Karen.
Yes.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it, and it was nice meeting you over the radio.
And we hope to have you.
Thanks,
on
Karen.
Again.
Appreciate it.
You're going to be thriving with. You're going to be moving ahead with. But Mob Wives, you may have a movie in the works, right?
Yes, we're heavy talks about a movie deal and another book. I actually like being an author. And, of course, I had an amazing person assist me, Lisa Pulitza. So, I mean, that just made it all the better. But hopefully if I write another book, Lisa will be available and we can work together. Because I think, and I'm not just, you know, bragging on myself, but I'm really happy with the results of the book. So
we definitely want you back on the show. Thank you so much, Karen Trevano.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you. Willie.
Good night. Good night, Karen. Well, thanks, Ron, and thanks again to our featured guest, Karen Gravano. It was a fascinating interview, and we're delighted to have her on our podcast. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our interview tonight?
Wow, it was really amazing. I didn't expect the articulateness, if you could use that word, to describe Karen Gravano, and she sounds like she's come to terms with her life, and just an amazing woman, very strong. She knows who her father was, and she's accepted it, and we wish her success with her future. How about you, Willie?
Great. Well, you know, Ronnie, I learned that Karen Gravano is over-the-top lawyer, loyal to her father, number one. She's one hell of a resilient lady. She has a wonderful philosophy on life. The book she wrote about her father, Sammy the Bull Gravano, is a turn-pager. That's for sure. I will urge all our listeners out there to get the book. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat History segment of the month. 25 years ago, Argentine Senate passes amnesty bill for military officers. Hey, Ronnie, on May 29th, 1987, the Argentine Senate passed legislation amounting to a blanket amnesty for the military officers responsible for torturing and murdering tens of thousands during the Argentine Dirty War. Wow. Hey, Ronnie, any comments on this history segment?
Wow. How many times have you heard that story, right? Human rights violators in a third world country commit all kinds of atrocities and go free. It was an amazing chapter, and hopefully someday some of these characters will be brought to justice.
Yeah, well, I hope they're not sleeping at night, that's for sure. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for June the 21st. Our special guest will be investigator William Deere, who will be here to discuss his explosive book titled O.J. is Innocent, and I Can Prove It. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to all our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we'd like to thank all of you for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Good night, Willie.